This is The Rotunda, your podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gone.
Well, we have a rumble in Tallahassee, Tramell. Richard Corker, the Speaker of the House, will be debating Andrew Gillum, the mayor of Tallahassee.
Florida's Capitol Press Corps president, Troy Kinsey, gives us a preview of the Sanctuary Cities debate.
Well, if we don't do that, we don't do this. And that this is usually, we're not going to see more patients. And that's a problem.
Heeding those warnings, Congress ended yet another government shutdown by funding, among many other things, community health centers. Andy Behrman with the Florida Association of Community Health Centers joins the program.
One of the things that make a community health center so unique is that the mission is to see all patients regardless of their financial status. So we see everybody.
Speaking of everybody, it was quite the scene at the Trump administration's one and only public hearing in Tallahassee on the issue of offshore drilling.
And it was quite the stunner. It upset the apple cart and really changed the dynamics of the discussion. Oil drilling has been sort of off the table here since around 2010.
That's Politico's environmental reporter Bruce Ritchie here with us to break down some of the big news shaking up Florida's environment. And we'll have so much more coming up on episode 137 of The Rotunda. Welcome to the program. We are halfway through the 2018 legislative session, and it is a little boring. Yes, I would say it's a little boring. Think about it. So far, not a lot of fireworks, the sex scandal, and Me Too movement that has led to a few shakeups is down to a whisper, to the pleasure of those trying to keep the lowest of profiles these days. Is it because it's campaign season? We'll get to that shortly, but not to worry. Some excitement is on the horizon as horse trading begins. The tugging of the purse will be over the opioid crisis, funding for education, and so much more. But let's get back to how this campaign cycle is distracting some lawmakers. Here's Bay News 9's Troy Kinsey in a sharp blue suit, talking to the people on the fourth floor of the Rotunda.
It is an Oliver Wicks suit, and I know I do kind of look like a lobbyist, especially standing here on the fourth floor of the Florida Capitol. But no, I am a humble reporter who has to save for months to afford a suit like this, but here it is.
You are an unusual reporter. People don't know. You're a pilot.
That's right. I'm a newly minted commercial pilot, have been a private pilot now, instrument rated for about 5 years. You've flown with me on a number of occasions.
Yeah.
And so I've taken the plunge, and I can actually fly for money now, so I can afford my Oliver Wicks suits.
So you're in charge of something big that's happening this week. What's going on?
Well, we have a rumble in Tallahassee, Tramell. Richard Corker, the Speaker of the House, will be debating Andrew Gillum, the mayor of Tallahassee. Gillum now is a declared candidate for governor on the Democratic side. Corcoran is mulling a run for governor on the Republican side, and they're going to be debating sanctuary cities, and I will moderate along with my esteemed colleague, you know him well, Gary Fineout from the AP.
Why sanctuary cities?
Because it's a hot button issue. It's made for TV. Everybody's talking about it. Critically, people on the street are talking about it. I mean, most of the issues that the folks up here debate at the Florida Capitol, you mention them to people at Lake Ella or Tom Brown Park and their eyes glaze over. They have no idea what PICO funding is, for example.
Yeah.
They have no idea what Florida Forever is. Everybody's heard about sanctuary cities. It was a compelling issue on the campaign trail in 2016, and we had a bill that passed the State House about 3 weeks ago that would crack down on sanctuary cities. Richard Corcoran also has requested the DHS investigate Tallahassee and St. Pete specifically for, quote, sanctuary policies. He believes that they're in violation of federal law.
But it's not going anywhere in the Senate. Why?
Well, look, never say never, right? Never say never. It could happen. It could very well happen, because in the final week of horse trading during a legislative session, a priority for one chamber, you know, might have to give way to a priority the other chamber has. So it could very easily enter the horse trade. Now, I think it's unlikely because the Senate is a generally more moderate chamber, and I think there are a number of moderate Republicans who are running for re-election or running for higher office in districts where, let's face it, there are a fair number of undocumented immigrants who live there, who have family there, who know people who vote. And so obviously for them, the issue is a touchy one, and I don't think that they would vote for a bill like this, which to your point, I think makes it more likely than not it won't even come up for a vote in the Senate.
Now, it's sort of unfortunate that this issue is being debated over real people's lives.
I'm not trying to take sides here. I mean, we've heard all about the undocumented immigrants who live in various communities in Florida who would be directly affected by it. The speaker will argue at this debate that hardworking Floridians are being affected by it as well because they're paying taxes. I mean, they're funding the local governments where these people live. And so he feels as if this is a drain on taxpayer dollars.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're looking forward to it. Where is it going to be? When?
We're going to be holding the debate at the studios of the Florida Internet and TV Consortium. They're the former Telecom Communications Association. Now, it's not open to the general public. You have to be a credentialed member of the press to attend the debate. I think you'll be there.
Yes.
On behalf of Rotunda Podcast. I think we'll have a number of colleagues on the Florida Capitol Press Corps who will be there, and of course we'll have multiple outlets covering it. I expect it to be carried live on Bay News 9 and News 13 in Tampa and Orlando, two of the biggest markets in the state. They're my employers. I think other stations will pick it up, and again, you can watch it live stream via the Gillum campaign and via the Watchdog PAC on Tuesday night, 8 o'clock, 45 minutes. Pretty short, in my opinion, but I think we'll still have plenty of time to include all the fireworks that people are expecting out of this issue and these two candidates.
All right. Thanks, Troy.
You bet.
Thank you.
That's Bay News 9's Troy Kinsey talking about the big debate this week. Be sure to follow at Trimmel G, that's my Twitter handle, and at Rotunda Podcast for the latest information regarding the debate. Community health center officials are celebrating after a brief federal shutdown ended with a bill that includes funding for community health centers. In a rare show of bipartisanship, Republican and Democrat Senate leaders announced a two-year budget deal that would increase federal spending. The deal appears to offer most of what Democrats have been asking for in recent months, including 2 years of renewed funding for community health centers. The bill passed by Congress and signed by President Donald Trump provides $3.8 billion for community health centers for fiscal year 2018 and $4 billion for fiscal year 2019 through the Community Health Center Fund. So as those health center officials across the country breathe their collective sigh of relief, joining us to talk about the importance of maintaining funding support for these organizations is Andrew Behrman, President and CEO of the Florida Association of Community Health Centers. Overall, he says while he's happy at the positive outcome, he wishes they weren't even in the position of debating the loss of critical resources in the first place.
Well, one of the key issues that come out of these kinds of federal problems where there's funding holdbacks or funding expirations, and then you've got to wait to Congress to go ahead and get it back into the bills and the budget and so forth, is that it makes it very difficult for any of our community health centers to actually strategically plan. One of the key elements that make community health centers essential is that the mission is to make sure that people, all people, everyone, have access to healthcare services, primary care services. If you can't strategically plan for the future, even the near future, in this case, when in fact the funding cliff, as it's been called, is put into effect, your hands are tied. You can't hire people. You're wondering if you're going to actually be able to afford the physicians, the providers that you already have. You may have had plans to expand the services through an expansion of your locations, adding more hours, all of those things that relate to a strategic planning model for the future are really put at hold. And that is a big problem because it's not just a matter of, well, we were going to do that and now we're not. Mm-hmm. It's more of a conditional, well, if we don't do that, we don't do this. And that this is usually we're not going to see more patients. And that's a problem. The growth for community health centers over the last, 15 or so years, even 10 years, go back as short as 10 years, has been phenomenal. Right now, nationally, about 27 million Americans are seen by community health centers.
How's it here in Florida?
We're one of the big guys. There's over 1.5 million patients that we see. And of that, about 48% of them are Medicaid, and another almost 40% are uninsured. So one of the things that make a community health center so unique is that the mission is to see all patients regardless of their financial status. So we see everybody. Mm-hmm. If you don't have insurance, if you can't afford it, you come to a health center, you are going to be seen by a provider.
So seeing that you see everybody, even those without insurance, how do you fund and support that?
That's the $64,000 question. The way FQHCs work, community health centers and federally qualified health centers, by the way, are the same thing. Funding for FQHCs from the federal level generally covers some of the operating costs towards the infrastructure of a community health center. Most health centers get most of their revenue through Medicaid, commercial insurance, other forms of insurance, Medicare, of course, and all of that rolled together are used to help offset some of the costs. But it really requires some innovation and some aggressive fundraising capabilities for health centers to be able to cover the costs of the uninsured. For Florida, I have to tell you, we are blessed. Since 2005, we have been able to participate in the low-income pool. That has a huge component of helping us to offset some of the costs for the uninsured. Mm-hmm. But this is a federal mandate. We're pretty much the only group that is mandated by the feds to say you will see everybody. And that's the altruistic mission. It should be that no one should be turned away for health care. So when we look at our strategic planning, you have to take into account that you're going to pick up quite a few uninsured. Now, in a state like Florida, where we did not do Medicaid expansion, low-income pool funding is a big help because that helps cover some of that uncompensated care.
Should we have done Medicaid expansion?
Well, certainly we would have liked to have seen Medicaid expansion. It would certainly have an impact on that population. So for the most part, it would have been the right move for us. But, there are so many factors that go into this. We're a part of that, but we're not the whole part of it. Having the funding in the continuing resolution or what would be maybe a two-year budget for this for us will certainly take that, will ease that, although 2 years is a short period of time.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes chatting with Andrew Bierman, President and CEO of the Florida Association of Community Health Centers. Bierman is hoping for a long-term funding patch on the federal level.
So let's talk about the Capitol right here. How are things funding-wise out of the legislature? Any concerns, issues? Are things moving along as you'd like to see?
Well, for community health centers, we actually have an appropriation line item in there. We've had that line item for quite a few years. We're very fortunate to have bipartisan support across the aisles from everybody. I think it's because of the results that we've been able to produce. One of the key things for us that I've always felt is that state money is our money, and we should account for all of it. So we provide a report to the legislature through committees and to the Agency for Healthcare Administration or the Department of Health, wherever the funding is coming at them, to let them know where every one of those dollars went, how they were spent, how does that roll back to increasing access to care. And the outputs have been very, very good. Health centers have increased access to care significantly over the years. So for this year, there's a line item budget. I think it's not a huge amount, but in some cases it could be considered a lot. It's about $4 million. Those dollars go a very long way because they're direct care dollars. We don't use that for infrastructure. We use it to make sure that we meet that goal of increasing access to care by hiring more docs, expanding hours in the centers, opening new kinds of practices. For example, community health centers provide primary care. They provide behavioral health. They provide dental services. All of them are obviously expensive. So those dollars are used to assist in increasing those services also.
Lastly, the importance of community health centers. Not long ago, they didn't exist, but there was a need for them to come into communities because it was an underserved area that needed to be met. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, that's a great question. You just mentioned something that is probably part of the problem with the community health center movement. We don't sell ourselves very good. Actually, FQHCs have been around since the late 60s, early 70s. Florida has had some health centers here since 1971. The centers are so engrossed in their product, which is serving the people, that I guess, for lack of better words, marketing is not the top priority. That's something we're trying to change. We are trying to get the word out, and we've spent quite a few years working with legislature, both at the state level and certainly at the national level, but more so at the county levels and at the level at home. These are, as you mentioned, community-based organizations, and they should be an integral part of the community's health system, and they are. But it takes time to get that, I guess the right word might be buy-in from the community. But health centers are very well established in their communities. We actually have almost 500 community health center sites across the state. We're in pretty much every county. And as I said, you know, 1.5 million patients, we serve about I think it's about 16% now of the Medicaid population in primary care. And again, we focus strictly on those services, comprehensive quality primary care. And to us, you're really going to make a change in the cost conundrum, if you will, in healthcare. If you don't do it at the primary care level, you're really not going to do much. You've got to fix it at that level.
Thanks to Andy Berman, President and CEO of the Florida Association of Community Health Centers. Coming up, the Trump administration held just one public hearing in Tallahassee regarding offshore drilling, and opponents got creative in sharing their oral dissent.
It's really difficult for working folks to travel to Tallahassee midweek to participate in this.
Also, Politico's Bruce Ritchie is on deck to discuss more about Florida's environment. Stay tuned. This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes, bringing you stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. Each week, this program is supported by listeners like you. So please send your generous contribution to rotundapodcast.com, which helps us to expand our reach. This program is shared through the Florida Press Association and newspaper websites throughout Florida and across the country through the USA Today Network. Follow us on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Rotunda Podcast, and check us out where you can easily hit the donate button on rotundapodcast.com. We welcome your generous contributions, including your story ideas, and as always, we thank you for your support. Welcome back to the program. So my next guest, Bruce Ritchie, we go way back. He was kind enough to hold an entire tour bus behind because I was running a tad bit late for a tour of the Everglades or somewhere exotic in South Florida. We were both members of the Society of Environmental Journalists at the time. And I'm so excited that he's steadfast on this very important beat. Speaking of which, it isn't clear whether Florida is still included in the Trump administration's plan to expand offshore drilling, but the first and only hearing about it was held in Tallahassee last week. Groups opposed to the plan had to get creative in an attempt to share their views. With no opportunity for oral public testimony, the organization staged what they call a people's hearing. They rented space in the same hotel as the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's meeting. Holly Parker with the Surfrider Foundation says they even hired a court reporter to record comments and allow people to speak to a brick wall to symbolize the Trump administration.
This is a huge issue of concern for Floridians. There's been discussion about whether or not Florida is or is not included in the plan. It's been very confusing, and we think members of the public, citizens of Florida, deserve the opportunity to express their concerns and make sure that that's included in the record.
So, Bruce Ritchie, welcome back to the Rotunda. What's going on with offshore drilling. Let's jump in with that. It's hot topic these days.
Well, we just held a hearing here in Tallahassee. It was a meeting, actually, of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, federal agency that's responsible for implementing offshore oil drilling planning. The Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, in January announced that a new five-year drilling plan, proposed plan, that included all of Florida and about 90% of the country. And it was quite the stunner. It upset the apple cart and really changed the dynamics of the discussion. Oil drilling has been sort of off the table here since around 2010 when the Deepwater Horizon occurred, and that quelled a lot of push both at the legislature and among business interests to open up drilling.
From what I hear, it's still off the table if we're talking to Governor Rick Scott.
The governor, who previously had been largely silent on the issue, announced his opposition to the plan right before it came out. And 5 days after it came out, and again, it's a proposed plan, 5 days after it came out, Interior Secretary Zinke flew from Washington here to Tallahassee to meet with the governor and announce at the airport press conference that it was off the table. Quite the turmoil happened about 2 weeks later when an agency official testified to Congress that Florida was still part of the analysis. You had a lot of Democrats at that point running around saying that that it showed that we weren't off the table at all. And I guess that's sort of the argument. If the head of the federal department says you're off the table, but you still have to undergo the analysis. It's an interesting issue. So yesterday there was at the hearing, there was competing press conferences and drilling opponents and people who said they support a balanced energy approach. They wouldn't say they supported drilling on the issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I even got an email just a few minutes ago from David Micah with the Florida Petroleum Council trying to emphasize their position that they think the state should go forward with opening drilling.
I had a chance to address about 50 supporters, probably as many as there were activists that oppose us at the open house, and talk to them about why it is so important that we continue the gains and the strides that we've made in America with regards to energy independence and moving toward what the president calls energy dominance. And that opportunity is before us. If we can get a five-year plan in place that includes more access in the Outer Continental Shelf.
It's still uncertain whether we're in this plan or off this plan, and we really don't know.
Well, again, it's the federal government that would open it to drilling, and I think he might be showing his support for letting the process play out, which would be a full analysis and information upon which to base a decision that supposedly has already been made.
All right.
One thing on drilling is it has sort of raised the profile of a couple of other issues that were under the radar. One was a couple of resolutions moving through the House and Senate. Both have cleared it and been voted on, asking Congress to extend a moratorium on drilling in the Gulf of Mexico off Florida, mostly for military reasons. And then also there is a constitutional amendment that has cleared its committees at the Constitution Revision Commission that would ask voters on whether to approve banning offshore drilling in state waters, which are closer to the beach.
All right. We'll see how those go.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes chatting with Politico's environmental reporter, Bruce Ritchie.
So, lawmakers, let's switch to the budget. Seeing how much money we have to keep the state open for business then the next year, where does the environment stand in budget talks?
It's a very interesting subject in the budget talks. The House and Senate are pretty far apart on environmental spending right now. The key area of difference is spending on the Florida Forever Land Acquisition Program. The Senate has $150 million in that program, which is a big boost. Actually, that program receives zero in the current budget. While agricultural conservation easements, those are payments to landowners, receive $10 million. So the Senate has $150 million. The House has $35 million for conservation easements and $8 million for the Florida Forever program. So it's a difference of 150 million versus 8 or 150 million versus 43. The House likes to sort of lump it all together and call it Florida Forever. I don't do that. Florida Forever is 8 million in the House budget and 35 million for agricultural conservation easements.
That's a big difference.
Yes, yes. And the House is putting their money towards other priorities too, like a citrus canker settlement, more agricultural programs and water quality programs involving ag.
So let's step out of the legislature for a bit to the Constitution Revision Commission. What is going on with any updates on the environmental front?
There were a lot of environmental issues that went down. Now, I mentioned one that's still alive, and that is the oil drilling one. There was a Jackie Thurlow Lipisch from Sewell's Point. He had a variety of interesting issues, an elected DEP commissioner, expanding the role of the Fish and Wildlife Agency to include habitat, not just species. Both of those went down. She had another one where it would establish a right of Floridians to protect the scenic beauty of the state and to take legal action to do so. And that really got the Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries uptight, and they went all out in opposing it. It went down. And there was one more that doesn't come to mind.
No problem. But man, look at the power. Like you hit a certain folks' nerves and they are able to get stuff off the table.
It was an interesting to see the fundamental issues really sort of being debated and discussed about. Oh, the other one is to require a much larger percentage of the Amendment 1 land acquisition money to go to Florida Forever. I think that one went down as well. It just really brought out some fundamental issues, whereas normally you're covering the legislature and things are getting compromised and amended, and there's bills that are introduced that never get heard. And never get discussed, like the plastic bag, lifting a state preemption on plastic bag bans. Mm-hmm. These bills get filed every year and they never get brought up. So it was interesting to just finally see a real discussion going on at the CRC.
All right. Well, Bruce Ritchie, thanks for coming back and updating us on what's going on in the world of Florida's beautiful environment.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Bruce Ritchie, Dave Mica with the Florida Petroleum Council, Holly Parker with the Surfrider Foundation, Troy Kinsey with Bay News 9, and Andrew Bierman with the Florida Association of Community Health Centers. That's it for this edition of The Rotunda. Remember to follow us at Rotunda Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Also, check us out at rotundapodcast.com, where you can contribute to this program and suggest topics and story ideas. And you can also be an underwriter by supporting this program. Learn more at rotundapodcast.com. And be sure to join us next week for more stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.